Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 44 of season 5 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today on this beautiful wintry day in the middle of July is Heather Baxendale from Word of Hellmouth.
Hi, you know.
I hope you have your winter coat on.
It's actually pretty quite chill today. I closed all the windows. I'm born and raised in Michigan, so I am not a newcomer to long winters, cold winters, hard winters by any stretch of the imagination. But this one lasted well over 6 months, and I might be a little bit traumatized by the sight of snow at this point.
I just
finished reading a book too, literally called Ledge, about a group of people who were put on this ledge and they were basically farmed. It's a fantasy story. It was fun, but halfway through it, I went, I can't read any more of this. I can't deal with any more cold. I can't do more snow. And then 2 days later, I watched Die Hard 2 to prep for the show. So I'm just torturing myself. It's good.
Okay. It's always nice seeing Heather torture herself.
Yeah. It's a good time. It's a party.
Yeah,
come
it is.
Join me.
That is definitely Yes. All right, so minute 44 begins with ominous music that's highlighting the antenna array on Endor right before it blows up. and ends with the SWAT leader, who we never know his name, starting to get a little angry. So basically we ended things yesterday by getting a very snowy shot of Endor. And I love mentioning the fact, I haven't mentioned it this week, that I know, but I mentioned in the past that Renny Harlin mentions on the commentary the fact that there is not a single shot in this entire movie that has real snow. It's all fake snow. They could not find, they had such a hellish time trying to find locations with snow. So it's all fake.
Did they shoot most of this in D.C.?
No. They shot in Denver. They shot in the UP. I almost went up to the UP to be in this movie. You know, a friend of mine told me that, hey, I just saw in the paper that tonight, you know, up north in Michigan, the UP is the Upper Peninsula for those of you not in the know. Heather understood what I was talking about, and
I do.
And so my friend said, oh, he saw in the newspaper, this obviously must have been like in January or February of 1990, when they were still filming this, that they're looking for extras to come. You know, they're going to be filming all night up north. And I was like, yeah, we should go. It'd be great. And I don't remember what happened, but we in the end decided not to go. And it's one of those things that I sort of regret. You know, I don't have very many regrets in life. You know, but not being an extra in Die Hard 2 when I knew I could have been, or at least I could have been there, whether I would have been on film or not is a different story. You know, even if I would have gotten there and you know, in the final cut I wasn't there, I could always say, hey, I was there. You know, or they said,
exactly.
They said, we don't have any parts for you, but you can just sit and watch. You know, that would have been fun too. You know, like that's one of those few things that if I ever had a time machine, you know, I would go back and tell my 16-year-old self, don't be an idiot. Go up north. Drive the 3 or 4 hours or whatever it is to get there. Do it. It's worth it. You know, you will not regret it 33 years later.
I think I'd have a lot of conversations like that with my 16-year-old yes. self. Specifically the don't be an idiot.
Yes, I understand that.
But,
yeah.
But yeah. I'm actually surprised, though. The UP has an obscene amount of snow most of the year, the cold months, and Denver, from what I understand, is a pretty snowfally place as well. However, I'm taking great comfort in this long winter of this now being fake snow. So now I'll look at it and I'll see fake snow. And
exactly. Now the scenes that do take place that I theoretically could have been in is when the planes land at the end. You know, that was what was filmed up north. Yeah.
That's really cool.
So, oh well, what can you do? It still will remain a dream. a dream of.
Just invent a time machine. Get yourself a DeLorean with a flux capacitor and problem solve.
Yeah.
Mess with the time continuum. Go ahead. I say mess with it. This timeline is a little bit broken anyway. Let's mess it up and see what we can do. Can't make it much worse. that's not true either. It can always be worse.
That is very true.
I'm so cheerful.
Yes.
Cheerful.
Of course you are. And that's fine.
For yes. You today.
So we get a few seconds of the satellite array or the antenna array, whatever you want to call it, and then we're back in the basement. You know, we're back with John.
Yes, we are with lots of steam.
With tons of steam. You know, again, we talked about this earlier in the week. This is not a healthy place. You know, not at all. There is far too much steam here.
Don't live there.
Well, that's what Marvin's doing. So, you know, I don't know.
I know.
Maybe he should have thought about it beforehand. I don't know.
Maybe it's having the reverse effect on him. Maybe he's actually not that old. He really was in World War II. And he just looks great for his age because he's been getting steamed every day for the last 20 years.
I mean, I'm still shocked that he's 52. You know, that the actor... Tom Bauer is 52 at the time that they made this movie. He does not look 52.
he doesn't. He looks like he's had a rough go.
And again, he's still alive today as of recording. So, you know, and I saw him recently in We Have a Ghost. You know, he has a...
Oh, yeah, he shows up all the time. He's one of those guys that is that guy where you go, oh, I've seen him in something before. And you go look him up and you're like, oh yeah, he was in this and this and this and just has, like, I think he was in an X-Files episode. I think he's been in a lot of those Vancouverian shows, a lot of the sci-fi shows. Yeah. He's been around. He's a busy man.
That he is. So we have John walking through the basement and then we start hearing, you know, his navigational skills because he starts looking at, you know, a folded up map and goes, main ventilation duct. Bingo. And, you know, then, you know, he figures that, all right, he's got to start crawling through the grate again. You know, he puts the map behind him and then takes off his sweater. It's in the middle of the winter with no snow, obviously. You know,
I know that bothered me.
but again,
tie it around your waist. You don't know if you'll need it. It's going to get cold.
But
man.
On the other hand, you know, you have all this steam. So he's boiling. You know, he's sweating like a dog here. So for him, maybe he wants to take care of, you know, just take it off. But then we get to see that, you know, he has his holster and then he pulls the grating off of the ventilation shaft, which is a little bit larger than the one that he crawled through 2 years earlier. You know, and then he starts, as he's crawling through, we get a little monologue from him where he goes, just once, I'd like a regular, normal Christmas eggnog. A Christmas tree, a little turkey, but no, I gotta crawl around in this mother tin can.
It's so great.
Again, do you?
And another reason why this is an actual Christmas
there you
movie.
Go.
It is. It's not just the theme. This it's actively happening Christmas around the event here. It is a centralized theme within the story. The John McClane Christmas.
Well, the John McClane Christmas is, you know, it already happened 2 years ago. So, you know. But, you know, it's very interesting,
true,
though,
very
that you know, when we get to the script, none of this is there. You know, I'm giving you guys that one. This is ad lib. You know, they added it along the way.
I buy it. It's perfect too. It feels that way. It feels very organic. It feels like that's exactly
correct.
What John McClane would say. And Bruce Willis is a fantastic actor, so I'm not surprised if he just pulled that out anyway. But McClane would be the reluctant hero at this point. He doesn't want to deal with any of this crap. It's been a really crappy day for him, pretty much overall. Car's gotten towed. It's not his car. He's dealing with the in-laws, which he's not fond of. His wife is already on a delayed flight. Then he gets here and she's about to go down yet again. Nobody wants to listen to him. He tried to pawn the problem off on somebody else. Nobody wanted to do what they were supposed to do. So he has to show up and fix everything again. So at this point, his budding frustration with just a normal bad day on top of terrorists in the airport. And somehow he's the only person who can save the day again. I love it. I love the reluctant agitation, but at the same time,
yeah,
shows up and does the job.
He really does.
And I love putting him in another air duct. I mean, come on. It's a trope, but it works. And the fact that he comments on it and bitches about it just makes it even better.
Correct.
He's laughing with you. He's laughing with
That's
you.
Right. I mean, one of the things that Rennie Harlan says on the commentary, and he says it a few times, and he even says it here, is that there are so many tropes that they used, that they created in this movie, that when you look at it now, you look back and you say, oh, everyone does that. But they didn't do it at the time. It's only been, you know, over the last 33 years that people are doing these things. So when you look at them, you're like, where did that come from? And then it's like, wait a second. That actually came from now.
I feel like the Die Hard movies and Lethal Weapon just kind of changed so much in the late 80s, early 90s, as far as action movies, the buddy cop idea. The whole entire thing. Yes, they are certainly, as he stated, tropes now. But at the time, they weren't. It was
all
new to an audience, which is something that we don't see as much today. So it was really cool. And I was a little
because now there's very little originality out there. Yeah.
No. And I don't mind as long as you make your own, you know, your own version of whatever the already has been done is. But as a kid, for me, this was like candy. I loved these kinds of. I should probably not have been watching any of these movies. I mean, when this came out, I was only 9 years old. I'd already seen the first one. I'd already seen way too many movies that I shouldn't have. But my parents were like, "Hey, it's fine. Go ahead. You understand the context." And I did. I did. It was much fun.
I've said this numerous times over the years. I'm still shocked that when I was 9, my parents let me go see The Breakfast Club. You know, in the theater.
Yeah. Yeah. We were the odd ducks in that capacity. Like, I remember going to Terminator 2 with my parents, and we were definitely, my brother's 2 years younger than me, we were definitely by far the youngest people in the theater. Nobody else brought their kids. And it was a matinee when we went, too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Very cool. Oh, we were the only ones.
Makes sense. So then the shot changes. We're back, you know, in the terminal on, you know, with the SWAT guys and Barnes back, you know, getting close to the Annex Skywalk. And they're actually, for some reason, running. I don't know why.
Yeah.
You know, they they have the four SWAT guys run, you know.
And again, I think just trying to create that sense of urgency, building sense of tension. No, they don't really need to. Maybe they do. I don't know.
Right. Well, I liked it in contrast to the original Die Hard, where you have a bunch of SWAT guys that are out of shape running. At least here, you know, these guys are in shape. You don't see them.
I think what you said.
You don't see them huffing and puffing.
I think what you said. No. I think what you said yesterday, too, about them probably being stunt actors and that's why they weren't included. I think you're probably spot on with that because none of them are doing much with their facial expressions. They're not really, they're kind of stagnant. They're just there, but they do look the part. You're absolutely on point with that. And they are certainly fit, every single one of those gentlemen.
Yes.
And big dudes as well.
Yeah. That is very true. So they show them running and Barnes is running with them also. You know, he's able to keep the pace. You got three guys in front and two guys behind. And then they reach a point where they see the walkway, right? There's a real term for it. It's not an escalator. It's called a slidewalk. That's what it is. A slidewalk.
Okay.
Which is basically...
I was wondering what it was.
Yeah. I mean, well, you've been on them. They're like, I think they call them like people movers nowadays or something like that. You know, where you...
I don't know. That's what I meant. Yeah, I've been on them. I've been in airports, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what the proper terminology was.
Yeah, for them. I it makes me wonder if are there places besides airports that have these, or is it just an airport thing?
I don't know, and I wouldn't imagine they make sense in airports, especially big ones. And Denver has them all over the place, but you have a lot of walking distance to cover in Denver too. I think Detroit does as well. Not as many or not as big, but I can't recall ever seeing them anywhere else.
Right. That's true. I mean, in When Harry Met Sally, you know, in 1982 section of that movie, they're already on one of these slidewalks. So, you know, they've in the movies, true, they've been around for a while, you know, in the Harry and Sally universe. And then Barnes picks up, I'm not sure if it's supposed to be like an early cell phone or if it's supposed to be some sort of walkie-talkie. It's hard to tell.
I think it's a phone. It might be a sat phone from the looks of it. I remember him putting it in the suitcase in the episode yesterday. Okay. I was looking through all the items there. So I actually watched him put it in there. It didn't have anything connected to it either. It looks like a sat phone to me. That would be
right. Because I mean, 1990 was,
which would also make sense because they could still use that with communications being down. Right.
Well, you can use a phone also. You know, a regular phone, a regular cell phone like we have today. You know, I mean, it's very interesting that, you know, 30 years ago, 33 years ago, so very few people had cell phones at the time. All right, so I'm looking back at yesterday's episode, and, you know, I didn't even think to look in the suitcase. That's really weird. So when he puts the blueprints in there, so we see all these wires, we see, you know, wire cutters and different types of tools. And yes, there is what it looks like a sat phone there. Yeah, I believe you are correct, Heather. Good catch. Yeah, you see, I missed that. So, you know, for some reason, I didn't even look. I don't know why. So, and in the shot, we also get to see that Barnes is married, because we see he's got a ring on. You know, we never hear anything about his wife, but at least they tell us that he is a family man, I guess you can say. And then
he will be missed if he gets on alive.
And the SWAT guys, I don't know. So he gives a report. He says, "We're in the annex skywalk. I can see the array. I'll give you a call for a protocol test as soon as it's hot. That's all for now." You know, and then, you know, they start walking towards the, you know, the area where they're trying to get to. And we see in the distance a painter who's there, which that is correct. Too? And so
I completely forgot that he was in this. I was so delighted. Great. I squealed.
That's okay. I can actually imagine that. So, first of all, we talked about this weeks ago at the very beginning, right after they shoot the guy in the second week of this, I think it was episode 7, where they shoot, you know, the caretaker in the church. So in the script, they have a few other scenes of their men taking over different places. And one of them is they kill the painters and take over the painters. No, so, but they cut that out. So, you know, we get to see.
Well, you can put the pieces together.
Of course. Yeah. No, but also in the script when they talk about that. So, you know, at that point they're showing, you know, they have, you know, team one in position, team two in position, team three in position. In the movie, it's just, okay, you know, Buckwheat, this is Buckwheat, we're in the clubhouse, and that's it. You know, and we talked about at the time that it would have been nice to hear another one of them say, okay, this is Spanky, we're in position. And the other one, this is Alfalfa, we're in position. You know, this is Darla, we're in position, or whatever. But, you know, it's not needed.
You can put the pieces together. It's not necessary, but I agree with you. I think it would have added that layer too. And in the beginning too, if they did that, it would have created a little bit more tension, even knowing how well organized they are and how well planned this entire thing is. It would make the entire possibility of overcoming it seem even more
right. And my drastic. Assumption is,
and it's just a small right.
yeah. But and my yeah, assumption is that in the 40 minutes in the movie since that happened, we would have forgotten about the fact that they killed these painters, you know, by a painting truck. They didn't kill them in, you know, here in the Annex Skywalk. They killed them, you know, by their truck. So, you know, you would have just forgotten about it over the nearly 40 minutes since then. And then you'd see them here and you'd be like, oh, wow, that's what happened. Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
That type of thing.
Exactly.
So then, you know, we have Barnes, you know, the five SWAT guys are all around him. You know, they're definitely giving him a lot of cover. You can see in the background when they're walking that there's like mirrors because it looks like you see a bunch of other SWAT guys.
That's I thought it was a separate team
walking
team
the other way. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, that makes no sense. And then I realized it was probably mirrors.
And then we get a shot of Robert Patrick where we finally get to see his face. This was actually one of his very first starring roles. He was an actor that was born in 1958. So at the time of this movie, he was 32. And as of recording, he's 65. No, he's not yet 65.
Thank you. Now I know how old my dad is. He's the same age as my dad. And I was trying to figure out how old he turned on his birthday. Right.
Robert Patrick will only be 65 in November. So he's got a few more months to go until he gets there. But I mean, his work in this movie, which is a very, you know, he's only here for you know, today, tomorrow, and maybe one or two days next week. But this got him noticed, what he did here. And, you know, he got his shot in Terminator 2 because of that, you know, which basically was the next film that he worked on after this. Okay. Now, yes.
And he does stand out. And it's not just because I recognized him as Robert Patrick, but he does have a look about him.
Mm-hmm.
He looks like a villain. He looks like a villain. He plays a great villain. He plays he plays a good guy too, but he plays a phenomenal villain. And he has a unique look about him. He stands out. And I don't think many people glow or quite like him. He can just, he does such and that's another reason why he was probably picked up for Terminator 2, his ability to do exactly that.
So I read something very interesting about him that you know, he started off in studying in university and then he dropped out after taking a drama course and decided that he was interested in acting. And at that point, while he was a struggling actor, he became a house painter. And in 1984, he was in a boating accident on Lake Erie, okay, where he swam for 3 hours in order to save the other people that were stranded on the accident site, and he himself nearly drowned while doing this. I don't have so much of the details of the story, but it sounds as if he, you know, swam back and forth trying to save people from this accident. You know, yeah, I'd really be curious one day to actually read the entire story of what happened there. You know, maybe I'll try and find it, you know, but well, maybe I wrote to him and he didn't respond. So, you know, just like all the other villains in this movie, none of them responded to me.
Shame.
Yeah, seriously.
Shame.
You know, I was hoping that someone would respond to me. You know, I see that, you know, William Sadler is very active in social media, and I wrote to him and didn't, nothing.
Yeah. Darn it, William Sadler. I used to like you. Now you're a real villain.
Yeah.
He's quite good in this, too. Another one that has that look. He has those cheekbones. He has the look about him, and then, you know, he's a good actor too. So he pulls it off otherwise. But it just has something sinister about him, and particularly in this one. Some of the glares he gives just kind of get you right in the soul. Like, okay, I will go cower in my corner now while you go do your villainous murder stuff.
Correct. All right, I'm gonna read something that I just found about this rescue. It says, you've seen Robert Patrick as the villainous T-1000 in Terminator 2, but you might not know that in 1984 he was a hero for a day. You might want to read the story to figure out just why. It's pretty interesting, and to find out just why, because it's pretty interesting. Back when he still hadn't entered show business, Patrick was a house painter, which doesn't usually pull down nearly the kind of money he does now, but is honest work and gets a person by throughout the year. In any case, he was around Lake Erie when he was in a boating accident that year, and rather than needing to be rescued, he nearly drowned after swimming for close to 3 hours to try and help those that were stranded at the accident site. If that can't be called heroic, then what can? Risking your life for others so that they can get away from a dangerous site is definitely a definition of courage.
Agreed.
Unfortunately, it doesn't really tell us anything more about what he did.
No, and that saying the accident site isn't like where a plane crashed or a car crashed. It's a boat. So how did the boat, where is it? I want to know more. I need to know more. I'm going to look into this. I have to find out.
Yeah, everything I find is the same information. You know, it doesn't go into details about it. It just says that he was in a boating accident and he swam for nearly 3 hours and
we're just gonna
in
have
order
to start
try to help
him.
Those that are stranded, that were stranded at the accident site. That's all it says, even on Wikipedia.
It's not fair.
So, Mr. Patrick, if you're listening, please get in touch.
Edward Furlong is going to be at our Comic-Con this weekend. So maybe I will corner Edward Furlong and say, I have a question about Robert Patrick. If you don't know the answer, please give me his phone number. Do you think it'll work? I could try it.
You can. Well, let's put it this way. As I learned from when I spoke with Tarantino a year and a half ago, you know, for 10 seconds, you know, when I asked him to be on my show.
Tarantino.
Well, you didn't know the story? So when I was doing my first season of The Great Escape, so I had heard that Tarantino is a really big fan of The Great Escape. So but hence, you know, why he puts that scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, with DiCaprio in there. So I then heard that he was highlighting the Jerusalem Film Festival that year and that he was introducing a few movies. So I said, okay, I'm going to go buy a ticket and I'm going to go to one of these movies. And I brought with me, you know, my laptop, and I said, I'm going to find a way to talk to him and invite him onto my podcast. I know he's probably going to say no, but I'm going to get the courage and do it. So I get into the theater and, you know, I get to my seat, which I always like being on the aisle anyway. So I picked an aisle seat and, you know, they're getting ready to start the movie. And then they bring Tarantino in with, actually before the movie started, I was walking around the hallways just hoping to like bump into, you know, him and the security guards or whatever it is. But that didn't happen. So then I'm sitting in the movie, and then he is put three rows ahead of me in this theater, also on the aisle. And I'm looking and I'm like, okay, when am I going to get a chance to talk to him? And then he gets up and he goes and introduces the movie. It was, what was the name of that movie? It was with Robert Mitchum from 1984. It was a Golden Globus film. Whatever, the movie itself wasn't amazing, but you know, it was still fun to watch it. And, you know, it was introduced by Tarantino. And then as the credits start to roll, so, you know, him and his, the people around him get up and they start to walk out and they walk right towards where I'm sitting. You know, so I quickly get up and I pace with him and I say, hi, Mr. Tarantino. You know, I have a podcast where, you know, I have a Movies by Minute podcast where I'm doing The Great Escape. And I'd love it if you'd be, you know, if you'd be interested in you know, being on an episode with me. And like, he looked at me the whole time. He's looking at me while I was talking. He was very gracious. You know, he didn't say, get out of here, stop bothering me or anything like that. And he looks at me and he smiles and then he says, no, I'm sorry, I don't think that's going to work out. And then he just continued walking. And, you know, I felt the satisfaction of at least, you know, having the courage to invite him. I knew the odds were that he would say no, but you know, some.
No, but Tarantino is a wild card anyway. Out of most people, okay, I would probably not be able to talk to him. And I don't get that way around celebrities at all, but I would freak out. I love Tarantino. I respect the out of him. But he's a wild card.
Yes.
He might have said yes. That was worth
Which
it.
Is why I
it
did it.
Worth
Which
it.
Is why
and
I did
nice
it.
Nice about
yes.
it. That's awesome.
Yes.
I five in ya. Feel it.
I feel it. I feel it 5,000 miles away.
Look what I'm reading right now.
There you go.
That's literally my read right now.
Very cool. Very cool.
He was just talking about The Great Escape and what I was reading yesterday.
Oh, wow. Okay. So
back to the episode.
Back to talking about Die Hard 2. So Robert Patrick, you know, who plays a character named O'Reilly, he turns around and looks at them. And then, you know, we see the SWAT guys in Barnes walking down the slide walk. And this is something I never noticed before I did research on this, you know, that one of the bad guys is actually on a ladder on the left-hand side behind them. Okay, that's
Yeah.
you know that that's that bad guy's name is Mulkey, Mulkay. Yes,
Yes.
he does, and he's played by an actor named Ken Baldwin, who has 9 acting credits on IMDb. You know, nothing really.
Maybe a stunt guy then.
Well, he doesn't have any stunt credits, so
No.
I'm not really sure about that.
Okay.
And you know, we see that what he's doing, you know, it looks like he's drilling or something like that, but he's not looking where he's drilling. He's looking down towards O'Reilly, I guess, you know, waiting for the signal. And then we get a
Yeah.
shot of another one of the guys who is painting, doing it very, very slowly. He's like on a scaffold, but you know, he's painting, but again, not looking at what he's painting. He's looking at O'Reilly. And this is an actor by the name of Mick Cunningham, who is credited in this movie as Michael Cunningham. He plays Sheldon. That's the bad guy's name. He also has 10 acting credits. So again, and it's very sporadic because it's 10 acting credits from 1989 to 2019. But you know, I couldn't really get very much information about him besides that. And basically, you know, so he's a good painter. He knows what he's doing when he's painting. You know, the only other thing that,
He knows that he's got to shoot some people.
yeah,
That's what he
and
knows.
according to IMDb, he is a retired NYPD detective. At what point did he
Oh,
retire? I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe that's why he's only been in 10 movies, because he was, you know, busy working, you know, in the police at the time, and just sporadically had, you know, different jobs here and there. Don't know. So yeah, he's just painting very slowly, and then we get a shot from behind him, where we see, you know, his point of view, and then he dips, you know, the roller into the paint can, but then you the screen the shot moves down a little bit, and we see that he has a gun in between the two paint cans. He has an MP5 there. Then we get to see the fourth and final villain henchman here. There's a guy who's standing behind a table filled with all his paint equipment. Do you recognize that guy? If you look at second 51, okay, tell me if you recognize that guy. The character's name is Shockley.
He looks familiar. Yeah, I remember he looked familiar, but no, I did not know
Okay,
who he
so
was, and
all
I
right,
didn't
so
look him up
this
either.
is an actor by the name of Mark Boone Jr.
Why does that sound
Okay,
familiar? Wait a
who
minute, that's he's from
he's
Sons of
been in so many
Anarchy.
things. Yes, he is.
Oh my gosh, he has no hair here. That is him though.
That is him. He has no beard. He has no hair. That's like you know, he doesn't have spiky hair, I guess you can say. He was also in Memento.
Yes, he
You know,
was.
he played the motel clerk, Bert. He was in Too Fast, Too Furious. He was in Batman Begins. He has 160 acting credits in on IMDb.
He was in the first season of Mandalorian for one episode. He also was on, well, we know he was on Sons of Anarchy, but Robert Patrick was on a couple episodes. I don't know if the two of them had any interactions. I'm not
That
sure.
I don't
But
know. That
they were, I think Robert Patrick was on at least two or three of those episodes as well.
Yeah. But what's really cool is that when I first heard that he was in this movie, when I started doing the research for the season, I saw that he's in this movie, and I'm like, no way. You know, because he's an overweight guy in every other movie that you see him in. And here he's pretty
Yeah.
much in good shape, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, the fact that he's clean shaven and stuff like that. So, you know, I was very pleased to finally be able to pick him out of, you know, the henchman. You know,
I looked
I've been
at him too
waiting
and
for
I went,
44 minutes to see him.
yeah. I looked at him and went, he looks really familiar. And I did go through the cast list beforehand, and there were a few people that I did look up and that kind of thing. And I probably skimmed past his name, but there were other ones where I went, oh my goodness, who else was in this? Who else was in this?
That's right. I mean, we saw I think 2 weeks ago, John Leguizamo has a very small part here also,
yeah,
as one of the henchmen.
And Cole Meany shows up without even a line. So yes. So yeah, there's lots of people that are familiar.
No, Cole Meany has stuff to say. He didn't have anything to say this week, but later on he will.
This is true. But yeah, so we have all these people that are household names to us that we are very familiar with. And that's one of the cool things about watching movies that are a little
older.
is picking those out now and going back and seeing all those goodies. That's really cool.
That's correct.
That's a fun find. Yeah. Well done, sir.
Thank you. And then Shockley, starts moving a cloth around. We assume that he's got a gun under there. And then we get a shot of a control panel and a hand that moves towards the control panel and pushes the red button. And then a red light turns on, and then the shot pans really nicely to the left, and we see the SWAT guys and Barnes still on the slidewalk, and the slidewalk stops, and they all fall forward. You know, I like the comic relief here. You know, I think it's on purpose that they did it this way. And at the same time, if you look in the back, you can see that Mulkey has already climbed down from his perch, you know, on the ladder that he was there. So the SWAT guys are a little off balance for a second. And then we see O'Reilly once again. He just turns back around and goes back to what he was doing, keeps his back to them. And then basically, I missed this before. As this is happening, so Barnes is still talking to the SWAT guys, and he says, "Sergeant, we may need some more equipment. I'd like to send one of your guys back for it." And he goes, "Right, sir, you got it." And then as he says that, that's when the slidewalk stops. And then, you know, he grunts, "What the hell's going on?" And then he looks over towards where O'Reilly is and says, "Hey." And then he gets cut off. So, you know, we're going to have to come back tomorrow to find out what actually happens with that. So
I think it's going to be bad. I mean, I've seen it a couple times, so I know. Mm-hmm. But I think it's going to be bad. I think things are not going to go well for our stock SWAT guys here.
Yeah, pretty much.
And John McClane is once again just hanging out in some air ducts while all this is going on.
Well, we'll find that out tomorrow. You know, we assume that he's still, you know, in the air ducts. So.
Yes.
So that's not a problem. So you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
Nope, this was a fun one.
Yes, it was. Tomorrow will be fun too. You know, every day is fun here. Come on, Heather. Every day. In the, what is it, the 540 episodes that I've done so far, every day has been fun.
Good gracious, sir. Well done. I admire your fortitude and organizational skills, all of it.
And I'm glad you keep coming back. That's the important thing.
Me too, because I like to have fun.
Ditto. So the script starts with a little bit of a description. It says, a big history of flight mural high on the wall, half finished, ceilings partially opened, a worker on the scaffold and three others on the floor, still hammering and fiddling. Barnes and the cops come in. Barnes looks out the window and sees the satellite array through the glass, still covered with factory plastic and tape. Barnes says into his cellular phone, "We're in the annex skywalk. I can see the dish. I'll call you as soon as it's hot for protocol test." McLean in the boiler room at night. McLean moves forward, stops immediately, looks up at Marvin, who grins. McLean's POV downward. He's high above the huge boiler room. The only way across is on a narrow beam. McLean takes a breath, starts across the beam. There's a scary moment at first, but he gets quickly confident. A bit too confident midway, he starts to lose his balance and all but runs to the far end and jumps to safety. As he pulls himself up, he hears Marvin clapping behind him. With a scowl, McLean checks his map and pushes on. First of all right, we'll talk about that in a second. Then it says Barnes and the SWAT cops run forward, get on the slidewalk. Impatient, they run even while on it. A worker at the far end of the slidewalk reaches into the open slidewalk control panel and hits a switch. The slidewalk jerks to a halt, and the six men on it almost tumble. Obviously, the worker turns his back to them again. The airport cop says, "Hey," and that's how we're going to end things for today. So, yeah, again, this is another time when I say I liked reading it, but it's not necessary. At all. It's a good thing
definitely
they cut it out.
Not.
You know, having McLean do acrobatics, not necessary. You know, not at all.
Nope. We already know what he's capable
That's
of.
That's right. So that.
Although, sorry, Marvin, so much of your time got
yeah,
cut.
Yeah, that's true.
Although we did have a brief explanation of why the SWAT guys were running. They were impatient.
That's right. Which is what you said. You were correct with that one. There you go.
I'm a very smart lady.
Well, that's why I keep having you back. All right. So every Thursday we have a segment called Aviation Thursday, where my guests will give their top five movies that are somehow related to airplanes, airports, flight, etc. So what have you got for us, Heather?
Okay. My number five is just funny. It's Snakes on a Plane. It's definitely not the best. It's not even that great in a funny sense, but I think I'm just going to give them the five slot out of sheer audacity and because I love Sam Jackson.
I was actually on the Lambcast episode. It was a movie of the month years ago, and we had a blast on it. You know, so
it's fun.
You can go back and listen to it.
I will, because it's fun. I was obsessed with it for quite some time. So it deserves a spot in the top five. For number
okay,
four,
that's fair.
I have Airplane, which is not a big shocker. I actually didn't see that as the entire movie until I was an adult.
Oh, really?
Number three is one of my favorites. It's Con Air. And if you'd like, go listen to the Con Air podcast right now, because
yes.
Jay and Mark are hosting it and it's delightful.
Yeah, well, they're finishing it this month. They finished in July. So, you know, you can catch up on all those 40 episodes. 40 plus episodes.
You should definitely check out the one that I'm on, because it's
And the one I'm on also was also
yes.
a good one.
We have the best ones for sure. And probably Jeanette, whichever one she does, because Jeanette is also wonderful.
Jeanette was on there too. Yes. That's
yep.
right.
Yep.
Number
Just
a
two.
Quick, so a shout out to Jay and Mark on the Con Air pod. You know, go check it out.
It's fantastic. They're great.
Yes.
Ton of fun too. For number two, I have Top Gun Maverick. I can't believe how much ridiculous, glorious fun that movie was. I was so happy. It was such a joyous return to that style of movie in cinema. I went and saw it by myself, and I swear I almost cried just out of happiness of being back in the theater with popcorn in my lap, watching that kind of movie and knowing that it's probably one of the last of its kind.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And they kind of even say sayonara in it, and that was part of the joy of it.
Yes.
It was really great. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. And my number one is also just Top Gun. Oh, it was the first movie I ever saw at the drive-in, first of all. Second of all, I probably watched it 100 times by the time I was 10 years old. I loved that movie as a kid. There are very few movies that are as 80s as Top Gun. It pretty much emulates everything that is the 80s style in it.
Yeah.
And it's just fun. It really hasn't aged particularly well. I'm not going to say it does, but that does not mean that it and the Danger Zone do not have a place in my heart.
Yeah, I'm actually a big fan of Top Gun, and I didn't like Top Gun Maverick as much. You know, when my list comes out at the end of this season, and I know Jay is taking notes, but Top Gun Maverick will not be on that list. Top Gun might be, but Top Gun Maverick will not be.
A lot of really great airplane movies, though. I had a hard time not adding in Alive. That one felt a little
Okay. That's
So
an
it's a
interesting
crash
choice to put
plane.
on there. Yes, it is. That is true.
It's a great movie. I think it's a great movie anyway.
Yeah. Okay, I agree with you. Now, I mean, for me, I think Top Gun Maverick would have been better. Spoiler alert for anybody, if they would have actually killed Maverick. That would have worked.
It
Because they
would
gave
have, but
us.
I'm glad they didn't.
I think the movie would have been better had they done that. Not because I
Usually
hate the
usually
not because I
I'm
hate the
for the
character or anything like that,
sacrifice.
but they made things far too unbelievable. You know, at that point, I know that watching movies like this, you're not supposed to believe in reality and stuff like that. That's fine,
No,
but
at
it
first
would have.
after I know what part you're talking about too. It was the unnecessary ending,
Yeah.
but it was the second ending. It was like a Lord of the Rings ending. But whereas Lord of the Rings, they're necessary. It wasn't necessary, but I didn't care. It was fun. And I've watched it multiple times now, and I still enjoy that. Plus, Tom Cruise runs. We have to have Tom Cruise running in a Tom Cruise movie.
That's
So.
true. Yeah, and you can ask Mark all about that also. Mark, I think did a whole series on Tom
Tom
Cruise
Cruise
running in
running.
movies. Yes.
Yes, it's brilliant. Utterly brilliant.
Yeah. So, all right, great. So, Heather, despite loving Top Gun Maverick, you want to tell people where they can find
Yes, I do. Specifically because of that. Even if you want to argue with me, go ahead
you?
and you can check out my book, which is a fantasy adventure story called The Prophecy. There's part one and part two available now on Amazon under my pen name, HB Walsh. If you'd like to listen to my podcast, which is a pretty groovy rewatch show of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. We are just starting the second season now. It's on Rabbit Hole Podcasts, or you can find it anywhere on any of your streaming services. It is called Word of Hellmouth.
Very cool. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. And finding me is it's simple. You just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So, Heather, you want to come back tomorrow and figure out what's going to happen?
There's going to be guns and firing. I'm for
Yeah, I think you're just a sitting duck.
it.
All right, so until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay! If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and